From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, film star Tom Hanks talks with us about his movies, including Big, Splash, and his latest, Punchline. In the late 1960s, Twiggy was one of the world's best-known fashion models, and almost certainly one of the skinniest. She's since become a respected stage and screen actress. Twiggy co-stars in the new film Madame Suzatska. Today she describes her transition from model to actress. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Randy Newman's new album, Land of Dreams. Newman has a reputation as rock's best satirist. This time Newman even tries his hand at a few love songs. And humorist Alice Kahn says she'd love to croon a love song, but you probably wouldn't love to hear her. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Tom Hanks starred in this summer's hit film Big as a boy who wakes up in the body of a man. And as Al Jean Harmetz of the New York Times put it, with this role, he crossed the line that separates a leading man from a movie star. Hanks' first starring role was in the 1984 film Splash. He played a young man who falls in love with a mermaid. That was followed by the film's Bachelor Party, Volunteers, The Money Pit, The Man with One Red Shoe, Nothing in Common, and Dragnet. In the new film Punchline, Hanks stars as a stand-up comic who's just flunked out of med school. He's the best of the comics at a hole-in-the-wall New York comedy club, and he's looking for his big break. But his arrogance, bitterness, and self-pity might be an obstacle. Sally Field plays a suburban housewife who's just getting started in comedy and wants Hanks to help her with her material. Before we meet Tom Hanks, let's hear a scene from the film in which he's polishing his timing by performing for patients in a hospital.
Another game is double up on the medication. This is, you take the pill and you put it on your tongue, and when they come around to check up on you, you insist it wasn't in the cup. It wasn't in the cup. There was no pill there. You need my medication. I'm sick. You see? Of course, those of you who are taking suppositories, you might want to pass on that whole thing.
Although Tom Hanks has starred in several comedies, he never did stand-up until he began preparing for Punchline.
We went into the clubs for Punchline, not so much for the research for the role, but to get the material the way it had to be for the movie. But I've known a lot of comedians, and I've been friends with comedians since about 1980 when I moved to Los Angeles.
When you went to comedy clubs to test out material for the movie, how were you billed? Were you billed as folks, tonight here's Tom Hanks. You know he's an actor, but he's testing out this material for a movie.
Well, that didn't happen until a little bit later on. For the most part, it was just we have a special guy, a special guest. You know him from this thing, and he's a guy, and he's done these movies, so here you go. Here's Tom Hanks. And the reaction was always good because, I'm a relatively famous guy. I am a celebrity who has done these movies. And so immediately these people who have just come to this comedy club to see, comedians now, suddenly it's like, oh, look, there's Dr. Spock at the next table. It was one of these kind of things. But that's very polite, enthusiastic applause for about, 90 seconds. It didn't help with the act at all. The material there was always left to its own judgment. They didn't laugh any more by what I was saying. They were just a little bit more excited to see me than anything else.
Well, did you feel very vulnerable doing something that you weren't necessarily that good at when you were starting out?
Because
you're very good at acting, but you had no experience doing stand-up, and there you were in public.
That was something that I knew I was just going to have to get over. Because we knew that the comedy material was going to have to work as stand-up material. It was going to require me getting up, how many times? I didn't know, 3, 4, 5, 10 times of getting up and really just being terrible in front of these strangers. Bombing. I mean, thinking I had 5 minutes of material and having it last about 40 seconds. Jammering, sweating, getting over the glare of the, the light in your eyes, and you can't see these people, and they're not laughing, and you don't know what you're saying anymore. It's really a terrible, horribly uncomfortable, sensation of being bad professionally. And I knew that was going to take a while to get over until, one, I got an act, and two, I became familiar enough with the act to be comfortable with it and kind of, muscle the audience then.
What was the difference between doing your material for actual people who were there to hear comedy And then doing it for extras,
you know,
on the movie when they were getting paid to laugh.
It was a battle. That was really something that had to be addressed. And to David Seltzer's credit, but more importantly, I think Ray Villalobos, who was the cinematographer of the movie, while he was setting up, while he was lighting and all that, the atmosphere could be in position and sitting down, but the microphone would be open. And so whoever the comics were, we were always spritzing with the people who were there. So it was like an ongoing performance. So when it came time to actually do the stand-up routines, all of which lasted usually about 10 minutes or something like that, they were, even though they had heard the jokes before, the comedians could then alter what we were saying. We had some inside running jokes that we could say. We were always changing the order of it, keeping these people surprised. Because they did. They had to show up in nice clothes and sit there for 8 hours listening to the same jokes over and over and over again. And we realized we just can't ask these people to laugh blatantly. We have to give them some sort of reason. We have to spritz with them. We've got to give them the zets. We've got to try to surprise them as much as we could in the confines of having to shoot this movie. So to their credit, I think that they were very game to sitting there and doing it. We had rate the takes, you know, we had games like this. Was this take better than the last take, you know, when we get thumbs up, thumbs down? We had a pool going in which the crew would throw in a buck a piece. And at the end of the day, the person who laughed the most honestly would get the pool. Not the loudest, not the most, just the most honestly. Would win the pool. So we had that kind of system going on, because otherwise we might as well have had just a laugh track, you know, just on off scream, cat calls, whatever.
Did you learn new things about timing when you were doing your stand up act?
Oh yeah, yeah, very much so. I think they're only particular to being a stand up though. I don't think it was a battle of learning that the phrasing is just like Sinatra has to phrase. The way you underplay one line before you scream another one is just as important as the material itself.
What?
It's a delicate ballet.
What's the best bit of advice you were given?
Drive this horse to water.
Meaning what?
That means that even though you have said this joke a second time now, you are not laughing as much because you said it once already, you've already heard it. Now it's another time. You have to say it again as though you're saying it for the first time. Just as a horse is driven to water, you have to make this stuff be fresh and funny and just as brand new. Now, this is, you know, all part of the suspension of disbelief that you kind of have to do to be an actor in the first place,
right,
as well as from the point of view of the audience. But if you're up there saying this stuff and you're communicating as though, look, I'm just making this up, folks, you honestly have to convince them that you're just making this up. It's a discipline that that is kind of, in some ways, particular to itself, but yet is also the quintessential show business performing discipline, whether you're a ballet dancer or an opera singer or an actor or a stand-up comedian. You have to make it seem as though it's the first time.
I like the laugh that you use in the movie, and I was wondering if that's your real laugh.
That one?
That one, yeah. Because I hadn't heard you laugh that way in other films. So.
There is a laugh that comedians do when they're not on stage, and I know there's a couple of guys who do it in the movie, Damon Wayans and Barry Sobel, but I've heard a lot of other comedians who do it when they're in the back of the club, either waiting to go on or just checking out somebody's act. And when they hear something that they think is funny, that's the laugh that they do. It's like that. That means that is funny. That's the highest compliment that one comedian will give to another comedian, that kind of laugh.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's really great.
Yeah. That's something that I found out in the course of the extensive research.
You know, I thought that a lot of comedy writers never laughed at all, and their highest compliment was just saying, that's funny.
Oh, that's funny, yeah. That's for comedy writers.
Right.
Comedy performers will actually let out that much of a laugh.
My guest is Tom Hanks, who stars in the new film Punchline that opens this weekend. You know, I think that this was a perfect role for you to have after Big. I know you actually shot the movie right before Big, but the movie opened right after Big. And I say that because Big was such a kind of lovable, innocent role. And in Punchline, you play a comic who's got a pretty bitter streak in him and who's very funny but isn't a lovable guy. And I just think it was a really nice balance to the role that you played in Big.
Oh, absolutely. I think also what they have in common is that they're very well written. They're very well defined by the individual writers. And because of that, I mean, that just makes my job a lot easier. And it's kind of the luck of the draw that I got two parts that were so well constructed and so easy to jump into. The guy, the kid in Big, it was a second skin of clothes. And Stephen, of course, that's like, I don't know, that's like a trip to the therapist, I guess.
Did you identify with the character, with his obsessiveness?
In some ways, yeah, but for the most part, I'm just not as unhappy as Stephen Gold is. I'm not as chromosomally damaged, it seems, as he is.
You got to do some physical comedy in the opening scene of Punchline, and in several of your films you've done some physical comedy, you know, falling off of bar stools, tripping over things. And I've never figured
falling,
out...
Falling, tripping.
Yeah. How do you learn how to do this kind of thing? How do you learn that you have a gift for physical comedy?
I think you just end up doing it. You know, you just kind of imbibe. You know, when you're up doing your roles. I mean, even back when I was in college and doing theater and stuff like that, it just seemed as though those kind of demands always came my way. And I don't think it's not a training. I mean, it's not like I studied mime or anything like that.
Studied tripping.
I did study tripping for a while. No. You just kind of do it. You have an opportunity to manifest your character, and you ended up doing it that way. But I guess I do. Now, I don't trip that much in Punchline, so at least that's something new.
Did you always gravitate to comedy?
Well, there's this theory that the world is broken up into two groups of people, the people that laugh and the people who make the people laugh. And I think I've always been one of the people who make the people laugh. Are these people born, not made, whatever. I think that because I was funny and comfortable with being funny, that gave me the courage to get up and be an actor in the first place. And because, you know, because there are people who are funny, they usually get the comedic parts. So I can say, yeah, I did gravitate to it, but I really just gravitated to being an actor more than anything else. I never thought of a qualitative difference between acting seriously and acting comedically.
You've gotten to work with a lot of really good sketch comics, Dan Aykroyd in Dragnet, John Candy in Splash, Jackie Gleason in Nothing in Common. And I was wondering if you picked up things working with them, since they did all these sketch comedy type things in addition to films, but they got their start during sketch comedy, which is, to my knowledge, something that you hadn't done.
No. Well, they also wrote all their own stuff as well, and that was really where the influence I saw. That's really specifically why I wanted to work with Dan, to see how he does this, because Dan also wrote the script that he also wrote Dragnet that we were doing.
Right.
I've been fascinated from that, you know, beginning to end process of writing it and then performing it as well. John and Dan also came from Second City, which is probably, I mean, they wrote the book on how to do all that kind of stuff. And of course, Gleason was, you know, one of the icons of our age. But it's not what I do. I think that's what I probably gleaned from the experience of working with them, is that I don't do that. I don't take that approach.
What's the difference between your approach and the sketch approach?
Well, I think that they're much more, polarized as far as the direction that they're going, because they have the upfront creative input into it. I essentially do what I'm told. The writer tells me one thing to do, and then it's supplemented by what the director tells me what to do. And then I end up, you know, bringing some sort of unspoken thing to do myself. That's what I do. Mm-hmm. I don't start off at the beginning. I come in a little bit later on.
Do you feel lucky to have started a film career and bypassed teen movies and, quote, Brat Pack movies? You really had your own identity right from the start. You weren't identified with a group, and you weren't in incredibly dumb movies.
There's people who will disagree with you.
Oh, really? Okay.
I have to agree with you. I don't think I've made a stupid movie yet. I've made some bad movies, but I haven't made stupid movies. And I think it's because of my age. I'm 32, which is, I don't know, it's not old school, and yet it's not, it's not the Brat Pack, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And part of it is also, my looks, for lack of anything else. I mean, I think I'm a relatively decent-looking guy, but I'm not particularly classically handsome. And yet I'm not peculiar enough to be like a character guy. So I don't know. I think I'm just one of these guys who, like in a pachinko parlor game, I'm just one of these guys, a ball that keeps falling through crack after crack after crack after crack until I end up somewhere at the bottom.
When you first started... auditioning, how did you test? What kind of roles did casting directors think of you for? Do you know the kinds of notes they took on you, the kinds of judgments they made about you very early on?
Well, in the early going, I ended up reading for like the weird guy an awful lot. The not the best friend of the lead character, but the guy who strikes out with the women, the insecure guy who supplements for his insecurity with being funny. An awful lot of those characters, which are pretty one dimensional. Because of the TV show that I did, because I was moved up to the front and was one of the main guys.
This is Bosom Buddies.
Yeah, that Bosom Buddies. I think that's where I was able to bypass an awful lot of those kind of stupid movies, stupid roles. That you were talking about earlier, because here I was a guy who had, I guess, somewhat an amount of emotion invested in this failure. I wanted the beautiful girl and never got her, and it was from my point of view, as opposed to just being the hard luck guy. I was the guy who the audience was identifying with. It's been so long now since I've actually been in kind of an audition process that. That's what I remember most, saying, okay, well, you're funny, so do this and do it funny. That was good. Do it funnier. And I could do that, so I would do that. So that's where I had attention paid for it. But, thank goodness I didn't get too many of those jobs.
Well, it's interesting. You've gotten leading man roles without being the muscle-bound hunk, and most leading men nowadays have to really have big muscles bulging out.
they don't have to. There's no law that's been written, but a lot of them do.
I sometimes think that there has been a law written about that. But anyways, has that been difficult to do to get leading men roles and not be the kind of stereotyped leading man, not have that kind of physique?
Well, I think luckily is the leading roles that I've had are, that physique was never necessary. I was very lucky is because the first movie that I did, Splash, with Ron Howard and Daryl Hannah and John Candy and all those people. I was the lead guy in it. I was the guy who gets the girl. And that pretty much just establishes everything. That, by definition, is a leading man, the guy who gets the girl. And because it was me, well, I'm a leading man. Mm-hmm. And the muscles had nothing to do with it, certainly. I can, as the movie speaks for itself on that point. So I was just kind of this guy who I think is the point of view of the writers who write these things. They would like to have the girl. They would like to be funny enough to get the girl. And they would like to see themselves with the girl at the end of the movie.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
Well, yeah, I think that's what they do. These guys just kind of write what they would like to be like. And because I'm not particularly threatening when it comes down to the muscle department, I get the job.
Well, I guess it's comedy, too, that that maybe in an action picture you need the muscles more than in a comedy.
Yeah. I don't know too many muscle-bound comedians.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some.
Joe Piscopo.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, yeah, there you go. There's only one guy.
Well, since you mentioned Splash, I thought maybe we'd play a short clip from it and remind ourselves of your performance in there. And this is in Splash, you play a young man who falls in love with a mermaid. And in this scene, you're coming home, and the mermaid is watching TV and weeping.
Madison, what is it?
Saddest thing I ever saw.
It's Bonanza.
A man killed another man and he died right in the middle of the street.
Oh, no. This is only TV. I thought you understood about TV. See, this is make-believe. This is just pretend killing that's going on here. See, now this guy, he's an actor, and next week he'll get shot on another show. When you think about it, it's kind of funny.
You know, I'm supposed to laugh.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I've got a kind of stupid question for you about the end of Splash when you're swimming in your suit and your shoes.
Yeah.
Was that hard to do? I mean, without drowning? I imagine you were in a big tub or something.
No, we were in the middle of the ocean
in
the Bahamas. Yeah. What was difficult about it was that I had iron weights in my pants. I had to wear they put 10 pounds, 15 pounds of iron in my pockets, and that was difficult, yeah, because you had to swim. Otherwise, you float up to the top, you see. And we were holding our breath, and we couldn't see anything, and it was very uncomfortable. Of course, Daryl had the tail. She could move around a little bit better down there, but it was hard, but it was the grand adventure of movie making.
Were there people on hand to give you artificial respiration?
Oh, yeah, we had a whole team of safety divers and all this. It was actually very funny, the way we did that. It's one of the goofier aspects of making... I mean, here we were making this movie about a guy and a mermaid, and they swim off together, and we have 82 safety divers and, you know, air compressors and a team of mechanics.
Right. Well, I want to talk with you more about your work, but first we have to take a short break. And my guest is Tom Hanks, who stars in the new film Punchline, which opens nationally this weekend. And he's also starred in Big Splash and Dragnet, among other movies. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Tom Hanks is my guest, the star of Big and the star of the new film Punchline. You have two movies in theaters now because Big is still playing.
Yeah.
And, your boyishness really worked so much in your favor in Big. Did you ever feel that it worked against you in a movie?
No. Because I honestly don't think I'm particularly boyish.
Right. It's true.
I know what you're saying.
I just feel that way about you having recently seen Big, but it's true you're not particularly boyish. You're able to find that and bring it out for the role. Let's play a really short clip from the role. And this is from Big, in which Tom Hanks stars as a 13-year-old who wakes up one morning in the body of a 33-year-old.
I want to spend the night with you.
Do you mean sleep over?
Yeah.
Okay. But I get to be on top.
Did you draw on your own memories of childhood, or did you draw more on what other young boys look like to you?
Well, it was really a dual-edged sword. I mean, because this kid was 13, that was a very specific age. And I think that probably 13 is, to me anyway, is still a much more vibrant year than any other teenage year, much more than high school. Because the body is just beginning to change so rapidly, and the world becomes such a confusing place. But at that time, I was also just beginning to become cognizant of world events and world affairs. So I remembered being completely confused when I was 13. But for the physical aspect of it, that was a mental preparation. The physical aspect of it was I observed the other actor who plays the same role, a kid named David Moscow, who at the time we made the movie was 13. And he had some very specific ways of moving and physical gestures. I also ripped off my kids an awful lot. Mm-hmm. I have a 10-year-old boy who, I observed an awful lot in order to put it all together.
You got a lot of things down, even little things like eating with your mouth open, coughing with your mouth open.
Yeah. It required a forgetting of an awful lot of stuff that I know as an adult now of what to do and what not to do. And we had, this big checklist all the time. Now, would he know how to do this? Would he be able to figure out how to make this thing work? And from a 13-year-old's point of view, I think it's the world is still a great mystery.
Are there particular movies or actors who inspired you to want to act yourself?
Robert Duvall was a great inspiration to me when I was younger. When I went and saw the Godfather pictures, it was Duvall's performance that made me sit up and take notice when I came out of them. Certainly, in all of the early films of like Martin Scorsese, these were guys who made me sit up and take notice. Earlier on, I always thought one of the best actors was Jason Robards. He was a guy who I would pay to walk across the street. I mean, I saw all the movies for the most part that came out. But these are the guys who I became somewhat the small champions of.
But it's interesting because it's exactly not the kind of movie that you've been making yourself.
Well, yeah, I know. Well, I don't know why that is exactly. I can only, I think it's because I've always been relatively funny. So to me, the funny stuff always takes care of itself. And the real challenge lies in the other areas.
So you think you've modeled yourself in a way on Robert Duvall and Jason Robards?
Well, I've tried to, but I'm not saying that I'm emulating these guys.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But I think that they're the type of careers that I've always wanted to have.
Now, you studied acting in college and did an internship with a Shakespeare festival. What kind of roles would you play when you were acting in theater? Would they usually be the Shakespearean comedies or the tragedies?
We did them both. I played Cassio in Othello and Rosencrantz in Hamlet and Falconbridge in King John. But we also played Grumio in Taming of the Shrew and Proteus in Two Gentlemen of Verona and Aguecheek and Fabian in Twelfth Night. You know, you do good roles, you do bad roles, you do comedies, you do tragedies, you do histories. That was a great thing about college and classical repertory theater, is you got an opportunity to do it all. But you also did, George Gibbs in Our Town. What was some of the other things? I can't remember the resume now. But you ended up doing it all.
Has acting changed your self-image or even how you physically think of yourself? And I'm wondering if the way you see yourself on screen is different from the way you'd always thought of yourself as looking in your mind's eye.
Oh, no, it's always totally... I always hoped that I looked like William Holden, and instead I look like this other guy. That's probably a very, very difficult thing about doing what I do, is that I have to look at myself so often, and it's such a... No one should have to look at themselves that much. Or hear themselves. I have this big nose and a squeaky voice, and
that's how you think of yourself.
Well, yeah, yeah.
So that's not how other people think of you.
Well, God bless them, because all I see is this massive. I keep wondering what squirrel ran through my hair all the time. it's very, very painful. I wish I had a career in radio instead.
lucky me, right? Totally invisible. Would you have marketable skills if you were in acting? Do you think of yourself as having other marketable skills?
I some sort of a salesman or something, like an insurance business. I worked in the hotels for a while. Worked in hotels.
Doing what?
I was a bellman. I was a bell service, bell boy, bell hop, whatever the appropriate term. But actually, bellman is the way you should describe them. I did that for a while, and it was... an interesting, fun job. Put a lot of cash in my pocket. But I have no idea what I would do other than this.
Mm-hmm.
I made a living for a while in the theater as a technician, as a stage manager, and as a carpenter. So maybe that. But I don't honestly think I have any other skills. I know that's probably bad to say, but this is the only thing I can really do. I've tried, even writing, or which I don't have the discipline for, or... I don't know what else I would do.
It seems to me that this is a turning point in your career, because you've gotten so famous and so acclaimed recently. I think we've all seen actors and other performers who, when they reach a certain height in their career, lose something because of why. I mean, I don't know exactly what it is, but the engines that seem to have driven them in the first place get turned down after all the acclaim sometimes. And I wonder if you have a little plan for preventing that from happening.
Well, no, not really. I never really have. I've never been one of those kind of things. I would like to think that the reason that I've done these jobs is just because they came across and they were different enough from the other things that I've done before, and so I go off and do it. There is a fear, though, that, this is it. They're going to catch on. There's nothing else here, really. I do this. This is what I do, and I can't really explain it. So maybe this is this is my 15 minutes of fame that Andy Warhol is always talking about. But I can't change that. I think that the reasons that I went into this in the first place is simply because I enjoy it and it's fun, and that hasn't changed. So hopefully it will not change.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It was really fun.
Tom Hanks stars in the new film Punchline, which opens this weekend. His other movies include Big, Splash, and Dragnet. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On the next Fresh Air, I'll speak with film critic Pauline Kael. Here's the toy piano duet from Big.
Jobsticks.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When the 60s ended, it would have been all too easy for Twiggy to become just the answer to a period trivia question. But Twiggy made the transition from the period's top teen fashion model to a successful actress. Coming up, Twiggy talks about her career, past and present, and her role in the new film Madame Suzotska. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from one of the sharpest tongues in rock and roll, Randy Newman. And humorist Alice Kahn shares her fantasy of being a singer, even though she can't carry a tune in a bucket. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. General Augusto Pinochet is expected to address the nation tonight after his continued rule as Chile's president was rejected yesterday in a national plebiscite. Opposition leaders hope Pinochet will offer his resignation. The military regime has acknowledged its defeat in that plebiscite, but so far has offered no concessions to the political opposition. More from NPR's Tom Gelton.
In the plebiscite, Chilean voters were asked to approve or reject a proposal by the country's ruling junta that General Pinochet continue in power until 1997. According to the government's final vote count, the answer was no, by a margin of about 54% to 43%. For the general, who has ruled since taking power in a military coup in 1973, the plebiscite had to be a stunning personal defeat. He'd campaigned hard for a yes vote, putting his credibility and influence on the line. Under the procedure outlined in the 1980 Constitution, which was drafted by the junta, Pinochet will remain in power until a new president is chosen late next year, and he would continue to be commander-in-chief of the Chilean army after that. But analysts here say the loss yesterday will inevitably weaken Pinochet's grip on the country, and authority may shift increasingly from the president to the junta. Opposition leaders are already calling for negotiations with the armed forces. Their top priority, amending the 1980 Constitution in ways that would make it more democratic. In Santiago, Chile, I'm Tom Gelton.
The House today joined the Senate in approving a bill to fight the dumping of medical waste. The legislation would require the Environmental Protection Agency to track infectious or dangerous trash from the time it leaves hospitals, labs, and clinics until it's disposed of. The measure is a response to the wash-up this summer of medical trash along the Atlantic coast and the Great Lakes. The House bill is similar to one passed recently by the Senate. Supporters in both chambers said they expect no problems resolving differences and sending a plan to President Reagan's desk before Congress adjourns later this month. The House also voted today to elevate the Veterans Administration to a cabinet-level department. With the voice vote, lawmakers rejected arguments that the move is too costly. The bill establishes the Department of Veterans Affairs as the 14th cabinet seat and the fifth addition to the cabinet since 1960. If the Senate follows suit and approves the measure as expected, the change would take effect next year. The Pentagon today announced a change in the cost of the initial phase of the Strategic Defense Initiative. Officials now say the first deployment of SDI will be a lot cheaper than previously thought. Michael Richards reports.
The new Pentagon estimate for the first stage of the so-called Star Wars defense plan is now about 40% lower than it used to be. Defense officials told Congress today that they won't need as many rockets in space to knock out enemy missiles. Pentagon planners previously thought they'd need as many as 3,000 of these so-called space-based interceptors stationed in space to be fired in large groups to ensure that some would hit their targets. A new guidance system is supposed to cut in half the number needed to do the job. This change is estimated to save nearly $35 billion. In June, Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci ordered the Strategic Defense Initiative reworked when it appeared that Congress wouldn't give the Pentagon as much money as it wanted for the program. Today's announcement is the result of that effort. But on Capitol Hill, skeptics like the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Sam Nunn, said they've seen many instances when the projected cost for a defense program is much lower than its real price. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
In Atlanta, about 100 anti-abortion protesters marched and sang hymns outside a clinic today. Police arrested at least seven people for climbing barricades around the Feminist Women's Health Center, one of seven clinics targeted by the so-called Siege of Atlanta. Those arrested were dragged to waiting police vans after refusing requests to walk the 200 yards. Organizers are claiming the 3 days of protests have prevented abortions, but clinic officials disagree. On Wall Street today, stocks higher. Dow Jones rose a little more than 1% to close at 2107.57. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Singer and songwriter Randy Newman is one of rock's great cynics, as you can hear in songs like Short People, Drop the Big One, and I Love L.A. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Newman's new album, Land of Dreams.
It's all these boring people. See them on TV. Making up all these boring stories about how bad things have come to be. They say, you got to feed the hungry. You got to heal the sick. And I say, we ain't got to do nothing for nobody, because, you know, it won't work a lick. They're just going to have to roll with the punches. Yes, they will.
When we last saw Randy Newman, he was driving a convertible along Imperial Highway in a music video crowing about how much he loves L.A. This most rancorous of all pop cult stars was attempting to ingratiate and alienate at the same time, a typical gesture of his ambivalent outreach. 20 years after he recorded his first album, Newman's life is pickled in irony. He recently told Rolling Stone that the reason it's been 5 years since his last studio album is not the usual one he used to give, that he was lazy, but that he had Epstein-Barr virus syndrome, the mysterious, controversial illness that leaves you feeling, well, very lazy. It's gotten to the point where even Randy Newman's crises sound like thinly veiled satires.
Old Mother Kane, meet us at the station. Dress as black as a crow in a coal mine. She cried when a little girl got off the train. The brothers and the sisters came down from Jackson, Mississippi.
For the first time in his career, Randy Newman is presenting a few songs as autobiographical works. This is startling because of all the singer-songwriters to emerge 2 decades ago, Newman was the one who derided the confessional mode as too easy, as simple pandering. Newman's new songs may or may not contain strictly accurate details about his youth, but they're certainly the most beautiful, lush, and atmospheric compositions he's ever recorded. Dixie Flyer is about Newman's childhood in New Orleans during World War II and what he remembers about being Jewish in a Gentile Southern world. This one, called New Orleans Wins the War, adds to the details of that life.
Mama used to wheel me past an ice cream wagon. One side for weight, one side for color. Remember trash cans floating down Canal Street. Rained every day one summer. Mama used to take me to Audubon Park. Show me the ways of the world. She'd say, here comes a white boy. There goes a black one. That one's a knock to room. This little cookie here's a macaroon. That big round thing's a red balloon. And the paper down here's called a picky. Here's a New Orleans too.
Land of Dreams is at once exhilarating and disappointing. His autobiographical breakthrough is matched by a couple of gorgeous love songs, another genre in which this most cynical of all pop artists has never indulged. But the prickly satire that Newman is best known for is rather flat here, an unnecessary reworking of old ideas.
Of all of the people that I used to know, most never adjusted to the great big world. I see them lurking in bookstores, working for the public radio. Yeah, the babies around, the sack on their back, moving careful and slow. It's money that matters. Hear what I say. It's money that matters. And the USA.
Well, that's a nice song. There's even that line you might have caught about public radio in there that'll get this song played on every public radio station in the country, I'll bet.
Trouble is, Newman already wrote a better song about this same subject, called It's Money That I Love, on the 1979 album Born Again. It's unfair, I suppose, to impose your own wishes on an artist, but you can't help it when you admire someone so much. I guess I was hoping that after this long silence, Newman would write something truly provocative, a tough-minded song about AIDS, or one about the Parents Music Resource Center, or a tune about how compact discs are a plague upon the earth. There's nothing on Land of Dreams that will enrage or challenge a mass audience, and as Newman proved a decade ago with Short People, even his novelty songs have the power to provoke. The only song I find even faintly subversive on Land of Dreams is I Want You to Hurt Like I Do, a heartbreaker that really means what its title says.
I ran out on my children. And I ran out on my wife. Gonna run out on you too, baby. Done it all my life. Everybody cried the night I left. Almost everybody did. My little boy just hung his head. I put my arm around his little shoulder.
Land of Dreams is pretty much Randy Newman playing to his cult, and so it's a limiting record. The themes he's staked out over the years, race relations and greed, seem to have frozen into obsessions. At the same time, he's created some of his warmest music ever.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. The name Twiggy probably conjures up the image of a model with a tall, ultra-skinny, boyish body and very short blonde hair. In the late 60s, Twiggy was the world's most photographed teen model. A lot has changed since then. Her hair is long now, she's put on a few pounds, and she's given up modeling for an acting career on stage, screen, and British television. She received a Tony nomination for her role opposite Tommy Tune in the 1983 Broadway musical My One and Only. Twiggy co-stars in the new film Madame Suzatska, directed by John Schlesinger. She plays an aspiring pop singer who lives in the apartment above Madame Suzatska, an eccentric London piano teacher played by Shirley MacLaine. In this scene, Suzatska's latest pupil, a 15-year-old prodigy of Indian heritage, visits Twiggy.
What's this one? Oh, that was a big launch of a new health drink. I'm the carrot. See that banana? I went to Australia with him. That's Tony.
Is this from a film?
Country Maiden Slimming Crackers, darling.
You look great. So are you a model?
Not really, I'm a singer. I write my own songs. Look.
Twiggy told me how she got the role of Jenny.
I got a call from the producer, actually, Robin Dalton, who's a lady. This is her second film, feature film, saying that she'd woken up in the middle of the night and had a flash that it should be me playing Jenny. She dreamt, and it kind of came on in neon lights, hysterical. And I was absolutely over the moon because I'm a huge John Schlesinger fan. And when I knew it was him, I thought, oh, great, you know. I mean, unless it's something I hate, I'm going to do it. And I hadn't seen the script or anything. The script arrived, you know, and one opens it, heart in one's mouth, praying that it's something you think you can do or that you'll want to do. And I love Jenny. We had a slight problem because the way the script was written, there was quite a lot of nudity, and I don't like doing that. And So my heart sunk, and I thought, oh, no, you know, I get offered a film by John, and then I read it, and, you know, I'm not going to be able to do it. So I went and had tea with him, and I explained, and he's a lovely man. And
what did you tell him about why you didn't want to do nude scenes?
Well, just my reasons, which are very personal, you know, that I just cannot do it, and I don't want to do it. I haven't done it yet, and I'm not about to start now at my age.
Mm-hmm.
And he understood and said, oh, don't be silly, you know, you'd look lovely. And I said, but that, you know, that's nothing to do with it. Anyway, we talked and talked. So I said to him, I really think, you know, as much as it breaks my heart, you know, you're going to have to go for somebody else. And he said, well, let's talk about it. And he said, it was written that way, but there's no real need for it. So we, you know, we did it without. And I think it works fine.
Your character of Jenny wants to be a pop singer. Her big break was when she had one record for 1 week that made it to number 96.
That's right.
On the pop charts. Now, you've had some pop records yourself, right?
Yeah, I have. I mean,
how
you know,
did they do?
Well, the first single and album did surprisingly well, actually. I was quite surprised. I think they were quite good, but, you know, when you come from another field, especially when you're a model, it's very difficult to break into other fields, as you know.
Do you think Americans still think of you as the skinny model?
Probably. I mean, I think even till I'm 85, when you say Twiggy, probably people have that image of the skinny legs, the short blonde hair and the long eyelashes. And I can't do anything about that except, you know, go on doing the things I want to do and try to do well. But it was such a huge statement in the 60s. It's very hard to kind of kill that. And I'm not ashamed of it. It's just, you know, it's 20 years ago. It's a long time.
I have to tell you, I still remember the very first time I saw your photograph in a magazine. And you were very thin. You had very, very short blonde hair.
That's right.
Long eyelashes with long eyelashes on bottom as well
That's
as
right.
on top. And they were mascaraed. And the effect it had on me, I mean, there's no way I was going to be tall and skinny. But for a few weeks, I started putting mascara on my lower eyelashes. tell me the story of how you got that look and
oh, gosh.
And the name.
I mean, it's really that's a long time. I don't really want to go into it in detail, all that. I mean, I've told that story so many times. I mean, and it's so long ago. And in England, the last 2 years, they've had a big 60s revival. And, I mean, I was asked to do so many programs, and I chose not to do them. Not because I'm ashamed of it. I loved it when I did it. But, it was 20 years ago. It's a long time.
Let me just ask you one question, though, about that. You know how really skinny fashion models have become the style in the past decade or so. A lot of people trace that back to you and to the image that you cut when you first started modeling. And some people have even said that anorexia can almost be traced back to you because you were so skinny.
But I was born like that. What people don't understand is that what happened to me was as much a shock to me as to everybody else. I didn't plan to do that.
To be skinny, you mean?
Well, to be skinny. I didn't plan to model. I was at school. You know, that all happened to me. It was a pure chance happening that fate happened at that time. You know, with the 60s thing going on in London with the fashion revolution and the Beatles and the working class thing. And suddenly, you know, with people like Mary Quant and Barbara Hulanicki designing miniskirts, all the models were too old. They needed younger girls. And I happened to be the one that was found and photographed and picked. I had nothing to do with it. I mean, I was, as I say, as shocked as anybody else when it all started to happen.
Did you feel freakish before you were considered fashionable?
Oh, sure. I hated what I looked like. Absolutely hated it. I would have given anything for, you know, a fairy godmother to wave a magic wand and make me look like Brenda Lee, you know.
You know, I think about how easy it would have been for you to be washed up after you gave up modeling at the age of 19.
Yeah.
Because it's not that easy to cross over from one field to another.
Especially from modeling, because there is that stigma.
That you're supposed to be stupid.
Dumb and thick and, you know. But you see, I didn't, again, it wasn't a conscious decision. I didn't think, oh, I'm going to stop modelling now and I'm going to go into films. You know, that's not what happened. I met a man called Ken Russell, who gave me the chance to do a film with him called The Boyfriend. And I said, but Ken, you know, I can't sing or dance. You know, it was a musical. It was quite funny, really. And he said, well, you go off to class. And so I went off to class and I did singing lessons and dancing lessons for 9 months. And then we made the film. And after that, I didn't really want to go back to modelling because it was like a whole new world opening before me.
Since you didn't have any acting or dancing experience when he cast you for The Boyfriend, do you know what it is he saw in you, what potential he saw in you?
I mean, that's the thing you'd have to ask him. Mm-hmm. But he obviously saw something and had a vision. And I think, you know, when people say, well, what do you think were your luck, the things that happened to you that were lucky, or the I think, it, you know, it's obviously meeting Ken Russell was obviously a huge moment in my life because he had the courage to go out on a limb on somebody that everyone says it's not going to work, you can't do that. You know, they usually back down in the end and come back and say, well, I'm sorry, I tried, but we can't get the money raised, I'm going to do it with somebody else. But Ken, God bless his heart, you know, he really stuck out. He would not have made that film without me.
In spite of the fact that you're not interested in talking about your early days modeling, you've kept the name of Twiggy, which is a name that really makes that association to those early days. So I'm really curious about why you haven't gone back to
it. It drives
me
crazy because I'd love to go back to it. But, I mean, you try and find a producer who will let you drop the name that you're famous for. You know, they say you're crazy, you know. Nobody, if we put Leslie Hornby up on a billboard, nobody know who it is. But how do you stop using it and start using in the name that nobody's ever heard? You know, it's almost impossible. I don't know what the answer is. Maybe you've got an idea.
how about Leslie Twiggy Hornby? And then after a few years of that, you drop the Twiggy.
We've thought of that, but that sounds just as weird, doesn't it? I don't know. I mean, I got married last week. And
congratulations.
Thank you. And so I've now got a new surname. And we did think of maybe my new surname is Lawson. And we thought of maybe doing Twiggy Lawson. But I don't know. We're still mulling it over. It is a problem, but on the other hand, it's not something that keeps me awake at night, you know.
Madame Suzatska is about to open. Do you know what your next movie role is going to be?
I've just finished a thing in England that will air on PBS here. We've done a 3-hour drama on the young life of Charlie Chaplin, which centres around his age from 10 to 16, and I play his mum.
Well, that's interesting.
And it was wonderful. I really enjoyed doing that. And that was a nice role because they had a very, very tough life, very poor, and it was not a glamorous role at all. I looked dreadful through most of it because the mother really suffered. I mean, she ended up in the workhouse and then in an asylum. It was rather nice to do something where I didn't look glamorous and looked absolutely awful.
Okay, well, listen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Twiggy co-stars in the new film, Madame Suzatska. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news coming up on today's edition of All Things Considered. Robert Siegel and guest host Alex Chadwick are busy putting together the show, but they passed on some information so I can fill you in. To follow up on last night's presidential debate, All Things Considered has called a number of newspapers around the country to check out the morning headlines, and political correspondent Linda Wertheimer will give a day after the debate report. Also, coverage of the opposition victory in Chile, which will force General Pinochet to step down from office. And writer and commentator Daniel Pinkwater has memories of a special hot dog stand in Chicago. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Fantasies. We all have them. Today, humorist Alice Kahn shares one of hers.
In my mind, I'm Alicia L'Amour, the recluse chanteuse. I saunter up to the piano in my simple black strapless gown and slowly peel my elbow-length gloves. A rhinestone bracelet dangles from my wrist. My fox wrap falls to the floor, as I begin to play Satin Doll. Then I'm Patti Page singing Tennessee Waltz. Segue into Billie Holiday singing I Cover the Waterfront, into Barbara Streisand singing the slowest, saddest Happy Days Are Here Again you ever heard. Then I'm Linda Ronstadt singing Blue Bayou in that opera singer with gallstones voice. In the real world, the unjust world, I'm a woman in a sweatshirt who can't carry a tune. But in the musical world where dreams come true, I'm Tina Turner in 2 feet of skirt and 10 feet of legs singing Proud Mary, Keep on Burning. My kids scream out, oh no, Mom, please don't sing. My husband forces them to leave the room so the performance can continue. He's learned through time that a medley beats an ugly female mood swing any day. I've always loved singing and playing the piano. Unfortunately, it's my curse to have been given a pretty bad voice, a tone-deaf ear, and no sense of rhythm. As a child insomniac, I would wait until everyone was asleep, and then at midnight take out my Hit Parader magazines and sing Mockingbird Hill, or If I Knew You Were Coming, I'd Have Baked a Cake, or The Wheel of Fortune until the wee small hours of the morning. My bedroom became the Club Trocadero, where ladies with gardenia corsages and men with thin sterling cigarette cases ate chili con carne and sipped sparkling champagne. Later, after I took piano lessons, I discovered that when my parents were fighting, music was my friend. I would sit there banging the ivories until they stopped. I really believed my music had charms. This was confirmed when I worked as a volunteer at a free clinic in the 60s. Maybe I couldn't bring down the house with my skills, but I could bring down an acid freakout like nobody's business. I just relax and let my fingers do the dancing. And still today, when I'm sad, if I can just get to that piano, I can save my soul. Sometimes I really am Janis singing Take a Little Piece of My Heart, and sometimes I'm Frankie singing Why Do Fools Fall in Love so sweetly that you'd swear the whole world was 14 years old. But somehow, I'm never, ever Little Richard, no matter how hard I try. My imagination has its limits. A few years ago, I tried to give my mailman, George C. George, a song and dance for Christmas. As he approached my porch, I came out singing and tap dancing, It's Mr. George C. George, the mailman, bringing me letters and maybe presents and maybe some money. He ran away as if he'd been attacked by a yelping dog. But I suppose that has always been the goal of Alicia Lamour, a woman in her music, to make the world go away.
Alice Kahn is a syndicated columnist based in Berkeley, California. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I speak with the father of splatter movies, Toby Hooper. His gruesome 1973 film, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, is in the Museum of Modern Art's permanent collection, and it's also one of the hottest numbers in video stores. Hooper directed the premiere episode of the new TV series based on A Nightmare on Elm Street. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Bird, director Clint Eastwood's tribute to saxophonist Charlie Parker. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Joanna Simon, Doug Loynes, and Georgina Sanger. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.